served as Deputy Dean of Social Sciences. He has been a resident associate of the Carnegie Endowment for the Peace, guest scholar at the Brookings Institution, a consultant for the Institute of Defense Analyses, the Center for Naval Analyses, and the National Defense University. He serves on the editorial boards of many scholarly publications, including Foreign Policy, Security Studies, and International Relations. He is the author of The Origin of Alliances, Revolution and War, and Taming American Power, a Global Response to U.S. Primacy. He was elected a fellow of the American Academy of Arts in 2005. Arts and Sciences, I guess it is. Our second presenter, Dr. John Mersheimer, is the R. Wendell Harrison Distinguished Service Professor of Political Science. I don't know how that fits on a business card. And co-director of the Program on International Security Policy at the University of Chicago. He graduated from West Point, spent 5 years in the Air Force, and then earned his PhD at Cornell. He has been a research fellow at the Brookings Institution, was a postdoctoral fellow at Harvard's Center for International Affairs, and the Whitney Shepherdson Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations in New York. Professor Mersheimer has written extensively on security issues and international politics more generally. He's publishing 3 books, Conventional Deterrence, Lytell Hart and the Weight of History, and The Tragedy of Great Power Politics. He's also written many articles for scholarly journals and more popular publications like The Atlantic Monthly and The New York Times. He was elected to the American Academy of Arts and Sciences in 2003. Doctors Walt and Mersheimer will speak for 30 or 40 minutes, after which they will welcome your questions. Thanks very much. Please join me in welcoming Doctors Walt and Mersheimer.
Thank you very much for that nice welcome. I want to thank Maria for the very kind introduction and also Eric for hounding us to agree to come out here. Even though the Red Sox are playing and it's the first game in the World Series. I'm sacrificing a lot to be here. I also want to thank all of you for coming as well. We're going to discuss 2 main questions today. The first question is there a powerful pro-Israel lobby in the United States? And if so, how does it work? And second, on balance, is its impact positive or negative for the United States, but also positive or negative for Israel? I'm going to address the first of those 2 questions. John is going to tackle the second. But before I get started in earnest, I want to acknowledge how difficult it is to raise this subject and why it does have to get handled with a certain degree of sensitivity. Now, if we were here to talk about energy policy, it would be natural for us to talk about the political activities of oil companies. And if I was here to talk about gun control, you wouldn't be all that surprised if I brought up the National Rifle Association. If my subject were the Indian-American nuclear agreement, talking about the political activities of various Indian-American political groups would be uncontroversial as well. But when the subject is Middle East policy and you bring up the Israel lobby, you are reaching out and grabbing the third rail with both hands. Now, that's partly because there are some groups in the lobby that are quick to attack anyone who questions the policies that they are advocating. But it's also because this discussion takes place in the shadow of centuries of anti-Semitism, including bizarre conspiracy theories like the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, and events like the Holocaust. And this history shapes how people think about this issue and how we talk about it. So if you talk about a powerful interest group that is mostly, but not exclusively, comprised of Jewish Americans, some may think that you're saying there is some kind of conspiracy to control American foreign policy. If you say that media coverage in the United States tends to be pro-Israel, it sounds to some people like you're making the old charge that, quote, Jews control the media. If you talk about campaign contributions by pro-Israel political action committees, some people may think you're saying that, quote, Jewish money is doing something improper or illegitimate. I want to make it clear at the outset that John and I reject every one of those various anti-Semitic conspiracy theories. For us, the Israel lobby is just an interest group, like lots of other interest groups in the United States. Its activities are entirely appropriate and legitimate. We don't question Israel's legitimacy or its right to exist, and we believe the United States should come to Israel's aid if its survival is ever in jeopardy. We also think that the activities of the Israel lobby and its impact on U.S. foreign policy is a subject that reasonable people ought to be able to talk about openly, the same way we might discuss the political activities of any other groups that try to shape American foreign policy, or for that matter, American domestic policy. So with that as preamble, let me get started. The late Yitzhak Rabin once said that American support for Israel was, quote, without compare in modern history. And he was right. It's the largest recipient of American economic and military aid, works out to about $500 per year for every Israeli citizen, even though Israel's per capita income is now 29th in the world. It's not a poor country like Burundi or Bangladesh. And it gets this aid even when it does things that the American government formally opposes, like building settlements in the occupied territories. Israel gets consistent diplomatic support from the United States, especially in the United Nations, and we almost always take its side when some kind of regional dispute breaks out. Israel is rarely, if ever, criticized by American officials, and certainly not by anybody who aspires to high office in the United States. Just look at the current presidential campaign, where every major candidate seems to be competing with each other to see how, to demonstrate how personally devoted they are to one foreign country, that foreign country, of course, being Israel. And the question is why? Well, the usual answer is that Israel is a vital strategic asset and a country that shares our values, and that explains why we give it such large and unconditional support. But if you step back and look at those arguments objectively, they don't actually explain it very well. Israel may have been a strategic asset during the Cold War, but the Cold War is now over. Today, giving Israel nearly unconditional support is one of the reasons we have a terrorism problem, and it makes it harder to address a number of other problems we face in the Middle East. I want to be clear here, support for Israel is not the only source of anti-Americanism in the Middle East or elsewhere. Our problems in that part of the world would not disappear if we had a more normal relationship with Israel. And the United States does benefit from some forms of strategic cooperation with Israel. But it's hard to argue that giving Israel nearly unconditional backing is making the United States more popular around the world or making American citizens more secure here at home. On balance, unconditional support for Israel is a strategic liability. As for the claim that Israel's a democracy that shares our values, yes, Israel is a vibrant democracy, but so are lots of other countries around the world, and none of them get the same level of support that Israel does. Plus, Israel's treatment of its own Arab citizens and of its Palestinian subjects is sharply at odds with U.S. values, not consistent with them at all. Nor is Israel's behavior significantly better than that of the Palestinians. I don't have time to go into the details here, but I think any reasonably fair-minded look at the history of this region, including more recent histories written by Israeli historians, shows that both sides of this conflict have done many cruel things to each other, and neither side owns the moral high ground here. And please note, I am not saying that Israel acts worse than other countries do, only that it hasn't acted any better. And so one cannot explain or justify unconditional U.S. support by saying that its behavior is somehow exemplary. I want to emphasize one other point. We think there is a strong moral case for Israel's existence based on the long history of anti-Semitism. And again, we believe the United States should come to its aid if its survival is in jeopardy. But its existence is fortunately not in jeopardy today, and past crimes against the Jewish people do not justify a blank check for Israel now. So what explains its privileged position? In our view, it's the Israel lobby. The lobby is a loose coalition of individuals and groups that works openly to influence American foreign policy in a pro-Israel direction. I'm thinking here of organizations like AIPAC, the Anti-Defamation League, the Zionist Organization of America, Christians United for Israel, think tanks like the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, the American Enterprise Institute, publications like the Weekly Standard or the New Republic. Now, that's a broad definition of a lobby. But if you think about it, most interest groups have several different components to them. The environmental movement isn't just Greenpeace and the Sierra Club. It also includes research groups, sympathetic local chapters, academics who work on environmental questions, journalists who write about the environment from a pro-environment perspective, in much the same way that the Israel lobby or other interest groups do. It's not a centralized organization, and the groups that make up the Israel lobby do not agree on every single issue. And it is certainly not a cabal or a conspiracy that controls American foreign policy. It's, again, just a powerful interest group that operates the same way other interest groups do. Its actions, we like to say, are as American as apple pie. One final point here, the lobby is not synonymous with all Jewish Americans. Surveys suggest that about a quarter to a third of Jewish Americans don't care that much one way or the other about Israel. Others do not support the positions espoused by key groups in the lobby. And some of the important groups that work on Israel's behalf, such as the so-called Christian Zionists, aren't Jewish. The lobby is defined by the political agenda it favors, not by ethnicity and not by religion. And finally, the lobby doesn't include anyone who happens to have a favorable attitude towards Israel. One has to be actively working to try and influence American policy in a pro-Israel direction. And obviously, some groups and some individuals are going to be more energetic and more influential than others. So how does it work? Well, here in the United States, small groups with a focused agenda often wield disproportionate influence on policy because they care a lot about a single issue. Politicians can win their support without losing anybody else's by accommodating what these small groups want. And like other interest groups, the Israel lobby works in two main ways. First, it operates effectively inside the Beltway by getting sympathetic people elected to office or appointed to key positions in the government, and by giving politicians clear incentives to embrace the positions that the lobby favors. Organizations like AIPAC, the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, work 24/7 to convince politicians to support their views. AIPAC's annual budget, by the way, is estimated to be about $50 million a year. It's very active on Capitol Hill, helping draft legislation, providing talking points for congressmen, writing letters for them to sign to their colleagues. It's a highly professional organization, very effective, with a large grassroots base. Now, AIPAC is not, despite its name, a political action committee. It doesn't give money directly to political campaigns. But it does help steer campaign contributions from individuals and from pro-Israel political action committees, of which there are about three dozen now in the United States. And those pro-Israel PACs gave about $55 million between 1992 and 2006 to shape American elections. That's just the PAC money. That doesn't count individual contributions. By the way, just by comparison, Arab American political action committees, of which there are a handful, gave about $800,000 in that same period, which gives you a sense of the balance of power. Over the past 30 years, AIPAC and other pro-Israel groups have also helped drive a number of politicians from office when they took positions that AIPAC didn't like, including Paul Finley, Pete McCloskey, Charles Percy, Cynthia McKinney, Roger Jepson, Lincoln Chafee, and others. I want to be clear here, AIPAC and other groups in the lobby don't win every time, but every congressman and presidential candidate knows that you're playing with fire if you question American support for Israel. That's why Steve Rosen, the AIPAC official who is now under indictment for passing classified information, once put a napkin in front of a journalist from The New Yorker and said, in 24 hours, we could have the signatures of 70 senators on this napkin. Or Senator Daniel Inouye of Hawaii explained when asked why he had signed an AIPAC letter to President Ford back in 1975, it's easier to sign one letter than to answer 5,000. Things are no different today. AIPAC was ranked number 2 in a National Journal survey of lobbies in the District of Columbia, tied, by the way, with the AARP. And it was also ranked 2nd in a 1997 survey by Forbes magazine. Bill Clinton said AIPAC was, quote, better than anybody else lobbying in this town. And Newt Gingrich, who didn't agree with Clinton on very much, said it was the most effective general interest group across the entire planet. Former Senator Fritz Hollings said, as he was leaving office, you can't have an Israel policy other than what AIPAC gives you around here. And that's why, of course, Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert said just last year, thank God we have AIPAC, the greatest supporter and friend we have in the whole world. Again, it's not just AIPAC, it's also a number of other groups and individuals, including a prominent subset of the Christian evangelical movement. So one strategy is, again, working inside the American political system in much the same way that other lobbies do. Second strategy is to try and shape public discourse and perception so that Israel is viewed favorably by most Americans. Mainstream media in the United States tends to be pretty pro-Israel, and that's especially true in terms of editorial commentary and in terms of op-ed columnists and pundits. If you compare coverage in the United States with either Europe or Israel itself, there's simply a much narrower range of views over here. If you look at pundits in the United States, for example, there's simply no equivalent of a Robert Fisk or a Patrick Seale, who write in the United Kingdom, or someone like Akiva Elder, Bradley Burstyn, Gideon Levy, or Myra Haas, who write for Haaretz in Israel. My point, by the way, is these individuals, who are often very critical of Israeli policy, my point is not that they are always right and that pro-Israel commentators are always wrong. My point is that voices like theirs are almost entirely absent from mainstream media here in the United States. But even so, watchdog groups like the ADL and CAMRA, the Committee for Accuracy in Middle East Reporting in America, monitor media coverage, organize boycotts and demonstrations and letter writing campaigns against any news agencies that publish anything critical of Israel. And of course, groups like Campus Watch monitor activities on campus and try to do the same thing to university administrators. So just a couple of examples. When Jimmy Carter published his book, Palestine, Peace, Not Apartheid, last year, the ADL and CAMRA took out ads in major newspapers, which included the publisher's phone number and invited readers to call the publisher and protest publication of the book. The Jewish newspaper Forward recently reported that CNN was coming under what it called unprecedented attack, that's the Forward's words, for CNN's three-part series comparing Muslim, Christian, and Jewish fundamentalism. Moreover, the Conference of Presidents of major American Jewish organizations was urging its various member organizations to take up the issue of this CNN broadcast with any companies that had purchased advertising time for the program. Finally, efforts to stifle criticism often include smearing critics by accusing them of being anti-Semitic. Martin Peretz of The New Republic said that Jimmy Carter, quote, will go down in history as a Jew hater. A critic in the Washington Post said Carter's views were very similar to those of David Duke. Needless to say, this was a common charge leveled at us, even though there's not the slightest shred of evidence to support the charge at all. If you read our book, you will find there is nothing remotely anti-Semitic about it, nothing remotely like the protocols of the Elders of Zion. Now, just to digress for a second, smearing people serves three purposes. First of all, it distracts people from the real issue, which is American policy and the different things that shape it. Second, it deters people from ever voicing any criticisms of American support for Israel or of Israeli policy, because who wants to get labeled with that particular smear? And finally, it marginalizes people in the public arena. Why would any politician want to associate with someone who had been charged, even falsely, with being an anti-Semite? And that's why people in the foreign policy mainstream rarely, if ever, say anything critical of Israel. They know it could derail their careers. The bottom line is, on this one issue, there's very little serious debate here in the United States, especially not in Washington and certainly not in Congress. Even at a moment in our history when it is obvious to virtually everyone that American Middle East policy has gone badly off the rails. Now, I want to make one final point and then turn this over to John. It is sometimes said that the United States supports Israel not because of the lobby, but because there is broad public support. The politicians are really doing just what the American people want. Now, this argument isn't persuasive for several reasons. It is certainly true that Americans have a generally favorable image of Israel, in part because media coverage tends to be favorable, but they do not think the United States should be giving it unconditional or one-sided aid. A survey conducted for the Anti-Defamation League in 2005 found that 78% of all Americans think the United States should favor neither side in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Another survey done by Americans for Peace Now found that 87% of Jewish Americans favor a two-state solution. A poll in 2003 by the University of Maryland found that over 70% of politically active Americans, that's people like you, favored cutting aid to Israel if it refused to settle the conflict. So again, Americans do have a generally favorable image of Israel. They want it to exist. They want it to be secure and prosperous. And I might add, so do John and I. But they're not insisting that the United States back Israel no matter what. But of course, that's pretty much what our policy is, and that gap between what the American people really want and what American policy is due mostly to the political influence of the various groups in the lobby. So now the question is that influence good for the United States or bad? That's an easy question, so I'll leave it to John. Thank you very much.
I too would like to thank Maria and Eric for making it possible for us to be here tonight, and thank all of you for coming out to listen to me and Steve. He has defined the lobby and made the case that it has a powerful influence on U.S. Middle East policy. What I would like to do is take this analysis a step further and argue that its influence has been largely negative. In a nutshell, our argument is that the lobby, working with Israel itself, has pushed U.S. Middle East policy in ways that are not in the American national interest. And I might add, not in Israel's interest either. I'm going to focus on two cases. First, how U.S. support for Israel's policies towards the Palestinians in the occupied territories has helped fuel terrorism against the United States. And second, the role of the lobby in the run-up to the Iraq War. There are three other cases that we cover in the book that I'm not going to talk about because of time considerations, but which Steve and I would be willing to address in the Q&A. And those three cases are U.S. policy towards Syria, U.S. policy towards Iran, and U.S. policy during the Lebanon War in the summer of 2006. Let me start with the first case, America's terrorism problem. The conventional wisdom among Israel's supporters in the United States is that Israel's treatment of the Palestinians has little to do with why the United States is so hated in the Arab and Islamic world, and more importantly, little to do with our terrorism problem. In fact, Israel is said to be a valuable ally in America's fight against terror, surely its most valuable ally in the Middle East. This received wisdom, however, is wrong. There's an abundance of survey data and anecdotal evidence which shows that U.S. support for Israel's brutal treatment of the Palestinians in Gaza and in the West Bank, and U.S. support for Israel's efforts to colonize those territories, angers, if not enrages, huge numbers of people in the Arab and Islamic world. The State Department, for example, set up an advisory group on public diplomacy in Arab and Islamic countries, which reported in June 2003 that, quote, citizens in these countries are genuinely distressed at the plight of the Palestinians and at the role they perceive the United States to be playing. Not surprisingly, that anger helps fuel terrorism against the United States. Let me emphasize that I'm not saying that our support for Israel's policy towards the Palestinians is the only cause of our terrorism problem. I'm simply saying that it is a major cause. Specifically, it motivates some individuals to attack the United States. It serves as a powerful recruitment tool for terrorist organizations, and it generates sympathy and support for terrorists among huge numbers of people in the Arab world. The hostility towards the United States, generated by Israel's policies in the occupied territories, has long been recognized by American presidents as a serious problem. This is why the official policy of every U.S. president since Lyndon Johnson has been to oppose the building of settlements. But no president has been been able to put meaningful pressure on Israel to stop building settlements. Indeed, as Steve pointed out, the United States has protected Israel from criticism at the United Nations and given Israel more foreign aid than any other country and given it unconditionally. All the while, Israel was building settlements in contradiction to American foreign policy. Of course, the reason that no president can put meaningful pressure on Israel to stop building settlements is the lobby. A critical issue when talking about America's terrorism problem is the matter of how U.S. support for Israel's brutal treatment of the Palestinians relates to what happened on September 11th. It's commonplace to hear Israel's supporters say that, number one, Osama bin Laden did not care much about the Palestinians until recently, and the only reason he cares now is because it's an effective recruiting device. Two, the events on 9/11 had nothing to do with Israel. And three, those involved in the attack hated us because of who we are, not because of our policies in the region. This line of argument is frequently purveyed by key figures in the lobby. For example, Robert Satloff from the Washington Institute of Near East Policy claims that bin Laden's identification with the Palestinians is, quote, a recent and almost surely opportunistic phenomenon, end of quote. Alan Dershowitz maintains that, quote, prior to September 11th, Israel was barely on bin Laden's radar screen. And Dennis Ross, who also works at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, says that bin Laden was merely, quote, trying to gain legitimacy by implying that this attack on America was about the plight of the Palestinians, end of quote. These claims, however, are simply not true. It's clear from the historical record that bin Laden has been deeply concerned about the plight of the Palestinians since he was a young man. That concern was reflected in his public statements and speeches throughout the 1990s, well before 9/11. Consider what Max Rodenbeck, the Middle East correspondent for The Economist, wrote in a review of two books about Osama bin Laden, one of which is a compilation of his speeches. And I'm quoting Max Rodenbeck now. Of all the themes, the notion of payback for injustices suffered by the Palestinians is perhaps the most powerfully recurrent in bin Laden's speeches. Regarding the actual attack on 9/11, we know from the work of the 9/11 Commission that U.S. support for Israel was a major cause of the 9/11 attacks. It was not, let me emphasize, it was not the only cause for sure, but it was a key cause. For example, the 9/11 Commission reports that bin Laden wanted to make sure that the attackers struck Congress because it is the most important source of support for Israel in the United States. The Commission also reports that bin Laden twice wanted to move up the date of the attacks because of events involving Israel, even though doing so would have increased the risk of failure. Finally, and perhaps most importantly, consider what the 9/11 Commission report says about the motives of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who it correctly describes as the principal architect of the attacks. To quote the Commission report, by his own account, KSM's animus toward the United States stemmed not from his experiences there as a student, but rather from his violent disagreement with U.S. foreign policy favoring Israel. It's hard to imagine more compelling evidence of the role that U.S. support for Israel played in inspiring the 9/11 attacks. In short, the present relationship between Jerusalem and Washington is helping to fuel America's terrorism. Let me now turn to Iraq. It's manifestly clear to most Americans that the war in Iraq is one of the greatest strategic blunders in American history. history. Our argument is that Israel, and especially the lobby, were two of the main driving forces behind the decision to invade Iraq. It is hard to imagine that war happening in their absence. To start with Israel, it was the only country besides Kuwait where both the government and a majority of the population favored the war. The Israeli government, to include Prime Minister Ariel Sharon, pushed the Bush administration hard to make sure that it did not lose its nerve in the months before the invasion. Other influential Israelis, like Prime Ministers Barak and Netanyahu, also implored the United States to take down Saddam. In fact, Israel was pushing so hard for war that Israel's allies in the United States warned Israeli officials to damp down their rhetoric, lest the war in Iraq be seen as a war for Israel. I might also add that President Clinton said in 2006 that every Israeli politician I knew thought that Saddam was so great a threat that he should be removed even if he did not have WMD. The Israeli public was also solidly behind the war. According to a February 2003 poll, that's 1 month before the war started, 77.5% of Israelis said that they wanted the United States to attack Iraq. One sometimes hears the argument that Israel opposed the Iraq war and actually favored attacking Iran instead. There is no question that in early 2002, and remember the war starts in March 2003, but in early 2002, when the Israelis first got wind that the Bush administration was thinking about attacking Iraq, key Israeli officials went to Washington and made it clear that they thought that Tehran was a greater threat than Baghdad, and that the Bush administration should focus on Iran, not on Iraq. It is important to emphasize, however, that Israel was not opposed to the United States toppling the regimes in Iraq or Syria, for that matter, two countries that Jerusalem considers mortal enemies. Israel simply wanted the United States to deal with Iran first. But once the Israelis realized that the war party intended to deal with Iran after it finished the job in Iraq, the Israelis enthusiastically embraced the idea of invading Iraq. Thus, between early 2002 and March 2003, the Israelis put significant pressure on the Bush administration to make sure that it chose war over diplomacy with Iraq, while simultaneously reminding Washington not to forget that Iran must come after Iraq. I might add that there is no evidence that Israel warned the United States that Iraq would turn into a quagmire. Indeed, the Israeli government, including Ariel Sharon, thought that it would be a cakewalk in Iraq, and therefore the United States would be free after finishing off Iraq to deal with Iran. If they thought that the war in Iraq was going to turn into a quagmire, they would have not favored it because that would have made it almost impossible to go to war against Iran, since the United States would be bogged down in Iraq. Turning now to the lobby, there's no question that the neoconservatives, one of the core constituencies in the lobby, were the main driving force behind the war. But they were supported by key organizations in the lobby like AIPAC. Now that the war has gone south, it's common to hear Israel's supporters say that the main organizations in the lobby did not push for war. But that's not true. This point is made clear in a May 2004 editorial that appeared in The Forward, which, as Steve pointed out, is a weekly Jewish newspaper. It's based in New York. I want to read this editorial from May 2004 that appeared in The Forward. As President Bush attempted to sell the war in Iraq, America's most important Jewish organizations rallied as one to his defense. In statement after statement, community leaders stressed the need to rid the world of Saddam Hussein and his weapons of mass destruction. Concern for Israel's safety rightfully factored in to the deliberations of the main Jewish groups. One sometimes hears the argument today that AIPAC took no position on the Iraq war and certainly did not advocate it. But this is not true either. First of all, this claim fails the common sense test, as AIPAC usually supports what Israel wants, and Israel certainly wanted the United States to invade Iraq. Second, there is hard evidence that AIPAC lobbied for the war. For example, AIPAC's executive director, Howard Kaur, told the New York Sun in January 2003 that one of AIPAC's successes over the past year was, quote, quietly lobbying Congress to approve the use of force in Iraq, end of quote. The neoconservatives, of course, were the main driving force behind the war. They initiated the idea of using force to topple Saddam in two letters written to President Clinton in early 1998. Over the next 5 years, and especially after 9/11, they pushed relentlessly for war against Iraq. No other group or institution in the United States was seriously committed to invading Iraq over that five-year period. Indeed, there was significant opposition to invading Iraq, even after 9/11, within the State Department, the intelligence community, and the uniformed military. The neoconservatives are, by their own admission, deeply committed to Israel. In fact, many of them are connected with key organizations in the lobby, like the American Enterprise Institute and the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Our argument here, it should be emphasized, is not that the neoconservatives or the leaders of the principal organizations in the lobby were pushing a war that was in Israel's national interest, but was not in America's national interest. On the contrary, they believed that invading Iraq was in both America's and Israel's national interest. For the neoconservatives, what is good for Israel is good for the United States, and vice versa. Although the neoconservatives were deeply committed to war with Iraq, they could not make it happen by themselves. They failed to convince President Clinton to go to Baghdad, and they had little luck selling the war in the first 8 months of the Bush administration. It was the events of 9/11 that created circumstances where they could help convince both President Bush and Vice President Cheney that invading Iraq was a smart idea. But without Bush and Cheney on board, there would not have been a war. I might add that Steve and I also argue that had Al Gore been elected president in 2000, we do not think that there would have been a war against Iraq in 2003. All of this is to say that the neoconservatives and the lobby more generally were necessary to have the war, but by themselves, they could not make it happen. One final point is in order about the Iraq war. We're sometimes accused of saying that war was a Jewish war. Nothing could be further from the truth. We pointed out in the book, as we did in the article, that polls taken before the war show that American Jews were 10% less likely to support the war than the general American public. Our argument is that the war was due in large part to the influence of the Israel lobby, especially the neoconservatives within it, not the American Jewish community. And as Steve emphasized, the lobby is defined by its political agenda, not religion or ethnicity. Let me conclude with a brief word or two about what we think the U.S.-Israeli relationship should be. To start, the United States should end its special relationship with Israel. We should treat it like a normal country. We should treat it the way we treat other democracies around the world, like Britain, France, Italy, Germany, and India. In practice, this means that when Israel is acting in ways that are consistent with American interests, Washington should back the Jewish state. But when Israel is acting in ways that harm U.S. interests, Washington should distance itself from Israel and use its considerable leverage to get Israel to change its behavior, just as it would do with any other country that was acting in ways that might hurt the United States. Regarding Israel's conflict with the Palestinians, the United States should act as an honest broker. In other words, Washington should pursue an even-handed policy towards the two sides. In particular, the United States should make it clear to Israel that it must abandon the occupied territories and allow for the creation of a viable Palestinian state on those lands. Jerusalem should be told that the United States will oppose, not tolerate, Israel's colonial expansion in the West Bank. None of this is to say that the U.S. should abandon Israel. On the contrary, the United States should defend Israel's right to exist within its pre-1967 borders with minor modifications. And most importantly, if Israel's survival is threatened, the United States, as Steve emphasized, should come to its aid.